Hey friends, welcome back to The Collective's Conversations, where we're having conversations at the intersection of faith and life. We've got a great guest, Joshua Broom, who is a former adult film star who got radically saved and now has this incredible testimony that he is sharing with the world of how Jesus has transformed his life. He also has a gift for our listeners. Covenant Eyes is helping fight against pornography and helping people overcome. If you use the code BROOM30 at Covenant Eyes, you will get a 30% discount on a subscription to help you overcome, or someone you know overcome, pornography. This is a delicate conversation, so if you got little ones in the car listening along, you may want to listen first and then let them in. But it's a conversation we need to have. Pornography is a terrible thing that is wrecking lives, wrecking homes. Joshua is going to share more about that. But this is a really important conversation. So now let's get to our conversation with our friend, Joshua Broom. Friends, welcome back to the Collective's Conversation podcast. We have a new friend with us, Joshua Broom. And first off, let me say congrats. Your fourth son was born as of the recording this week. So that's probably the biggest news going on in your life.
Absolutely. But
Josh is a former adult film star who goes radically saved and is now a full-time pastor, minister, and really helping share and shed light on the porn industry. And so we're just excited. Thanks for coming on to have this conversation with us.
Absolutely. It's my joy to do all the things that God allows me to do. And thank you for celebrating the birth of little baby Abel. So we got four boys. So super excited about that. So not a ton of sleep, but far more than my wife is getting. So
is there you're gonna try for one more and get a basketball team? Are you going for five? Is that the plan?
Yeah. So every time someone says that, I remind them that I am a basketball player. So we have a five, including me. But my wife and I were talking about it, and it's definitely on the table.
Okay. So you'll be coach player kind of in the conversation.
Yeah. Love it.
So you mentioned basketball player. I know you played in high school. So I grew up around Chicago. So I know who my GOAT is. But when we talk basketball for you, who's the greatest of all time, Joshua? Who do you got in that conversation?
Well, I mean, I would say Jordan is the greatest of all time, but my favorite player of all time was Kobe. So huge Kobe fan. Loved watching him growing up, and I lived in Los Angeles kind of like in his heyday. So I was at Staples Center as often as I could be.
I don't think Kobe gets as much credit in the conversation as he should. Like, everybody's a Jordan LeBron kind of argument. Kobe was fantastic.
But I would say, like, you look at Kobe, and you know, Kobe was, you know, you're 6'6". You know, he wasn't like this, you know, phenomenally gifted player. You know, Jordan had this astronomical vertical, like, you know, absolutely gifted from you know, definitely like the best mental game of, you know, anyone in any sport, arguably. But, you know, Kobe pretty much like this above average athlete with this above average work ethic. And it was his attention to detail. If you just like, I love listening to him just talk about how he was so frustrated that he couldn't figure out how to defend Kevin Durant, and how through he like developed his left hand, and there were so many nuances of his game that he wanted to figure out how to stop him. And he was like, Kevin Durant was the only player that when he retired, he hadn't figured out how to stop him because he could articulate crystal clear, well, this player is going to do this. I'm going to defend him by knowing what he's going to do. And it was through his preparation. So that was the thing that I admired most about him. Obviously, incredibly gifted, great player, but I just loved his attention to detail.
I don't want to overly promote another podcast, because you have a podcast, which is great, and I have this podcast, but there is a limited series podcast, and I can't remember the name of it. It may be called The Kobe Tapes.
Okay.
I don't know if you've listened to this.
Yeah.
But it's basically this reporter that he knew when he was in Philadelphia who had these tape recordings of high school Kobe. And they kind of tell the story of Kobe in high school and the Mamba mentality. So I know you're not sleeping much now with the fourth child, fourth son born. So maybe in between feedings, you can listen to that. But it's a great listen for our friends that don't like explicit content. They cut us a little bit in that one. So
yeah.
But let's get to your story. It's super interesting that how does a kid from South Carolina end up in the adult film business?
Yeah. So I grew up in a small town in South Carolina, and around 13 or 14 started modeling and acting, and then go to college, studied theater. And so being in entertainment was always something that I was pursuing. Mm-hmm. And then second semester of my sophomore year of college, dropped out of college, moved to Hollywood, got an agent, and was pursuing acting and modeling. I had more success modeling than I had acting, but yeah, was out there, you know, had an agent, was going on in, you know, was going to auditions, you know, living the life, doing what I set out to do and having some success in the process. But, you know, to mitigate expenses, like most people who are chasing their dreams in their early 20s, you had to get another source of income to, you know, pay your bills. And right. I'm working at this restaurant / bar in the middle of West Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard, like right in the thick of things. And in walk these three girls, and they invited me into the porn industry. And I was already living a pretty promiscuous lifestyle. I grew up without a father, low income family, and you know, tried my very best in spite of my mom giving me everything that I needed. Incredible mom. But I didn't have any men speaking into my life. I never had you know, that man that taught me what it meant to be a man. So in contrary to you know what Romans 12:2 is talking about, it's like the world was the thing that was conforming me. The world was shaping the way that I saw myself, the way that what, you know, who I thought I was supposed to be as a man. And really this lost kid that was, you know, seeking the approval of others in hopes that that approval would fix the, you know, the wound that I had in my heart, because I felt rejected. I felt inadequate because my dad was in the same town that I lived in. He was just never in my life. So the thing that I wanted most was right around the corner, and I got reminded essentially, you know, every day, well, I must not be good enough, or there must be something wrong with me, or, you know, so on and so forth, the lie that I continue to feed myself. And, you know, so I end up out there in LA and get presented with this opportunity to do a porn scene. And I, you know, ignorantly thought, well, I could do this and we'll see, you know, how much harm could it do to my life? It's not a big deal. But very quickly I learned I did that, and it was everywhere all over the internet, and people found out about it. My family, the people who represented me professionally. So those, you know, those relationships ended. I could no longer pursue the dream that I was pursuing, because, you know, organizations and just, you know, the people that represented me as a talent, they were like, hey, we have clear boundaries, very clear language in these contracts that, you know, if you're doing something or living in a way that's contradictory of who we want to portray ourselves to be, we can't represent you. So that was over and done with. And then after I did that scene, I didn't really know what to do. And I believed, well, there's nothing else that I could do, which is, again, another lie. You know, it's so easy to believe, well, because you made this blunder, or you made this mistake, or you made this decision, the only thing that you can do now is continuing living in the compromise in which, you know, you got yourself into. And that's the easiest way out. You know, the hard way is, saying, okay, I made a mistake. I need to now, move into a different direction, learn another skill, go down another path. Because I was 22 at the time. There were other things wow. I could have done, but what I chose to do was to continue doing porn. And I stayed in that industry for 6 years. And while I was in that industry, again, I believed, well, if this is the cards that I've been dealt, the best thing I could do would be to become the best. And that would maybe then, fill the void I had in my heart. If I became the best and I won the awards and I made the money, maybe I would feel good about myself. And I did those things. I won Performer of the Year. I made over $1 million. I did all these things. I became famous. Even though ironically, the first thing you do when you join the porn industry is you surrender your name. You go by a pseudonym. So you don't even, like, Joshua Broom never even became famous. This fictitious version of myself
right.
became famous. And on the other side of making the money and becoming famous and doing all these things, I was left with unsatisfaction. I was left with amplified anxiety, deepened depression, and I ended up making a plan to take my life. And through an interaction with a bank teller where I took a check to deposit on the day that I was going to take my life, and on the check, on the memo portion, it said something grotesque. Directors would write, the name of the movie or an act or something, almost being antagonistic to the performer. Mm-hmm. And I took that check into this bank to really justify what I'd planned to do, which was to take my life. And I slid the check across the counter and waited for her to confirm the thoughts that I had about myself. And I was assuming that she would say something, condescending or at least make some kind of face of disgust. And instead, she looked me in the eyes and said, "Joshua, are you okay? Joshua, can I help you?" And what she didn't know is that I had disassociated myself from so many people in my life that I hadn't even heard my real name in over a year. Wow. So the place that I went and the person that I sought to confirm, to justify me taking my life, she actually saved my life through such a simple act, just saying my name. And I ran home and I called my mom and, I said, I'm sorry that I hadn't called you and, had this conversation. And at the end of it, I decided that I was going to quit. And I left the industry and, there was about a 2 year gap between that day and then the next most important day of my life where I was working at a gym. So get out of the industry. I'm working at a CrossFit gym. And I'm working at a Whole Foods. Eventually I got to the point where I was making enough money working at the gym that I didn't need to work at the Whole Foods. And, I asked this girl out on a date and she says no, but she agreed to a run and we're out on this run and I'm there early and I'm thinking like, gosh, I need to tell this girl like my path yeah. and to share with her the thing because I had lied to so many people about my past yeah. and it was ruining friendship after relationship, like nearly gotten fired because I hadn't told people about my past. And I was like, I'm just going to do her a favor and I want to do me a favor because if I tell her, she's not going to want anything to do with me, but also she's not going to find out after the fact and then mm-hmm. not going to blow up in my face. So I thought, okay, I'm going to tell her she's not going to want anything to do with me. And I tell her, I'm like, hey, this is the type of person I am. Here's the life that I've lived. Essentially, here's a monologue of how bad I am as a person. And yeah. she listens and she's pretty distraught at what she heard. And she's just processing. And it seemed like, you know, 10 minutes went by without her saying anything. It was probably like 30 seconds. And then she looks at me and she gets really serious. And she's like, well, do you know a person's not defined by the worst thing they've ever done? And a person's not defined by the greatest thing they'll ever do. God defines who a person is. He created everything. He created you and me. And he has the final say. Do you know who God is? And I didn't. I believed that I had some kind of relationship with God just because I went to church early on in my life, like until I was about 7 or 8. And I believed that God existed, but I certainly didn't have a relationship with him that comes through the person of Christ. But I thought that I did. I thought that, okay, well, you know, the two boxes were he's real and he created me. So if I acknowledge those things, then I thought that made me a Christian. But she straightened me out. She straightened me right out. But she was, it was a perfect.
Josh, I want to ask just, and I want to finish hearing the story, but I'm intrigued in this 8-year span. So the 6 years in the industry and the 2 years at CrossFit and Whole Foods before we meet Hope, who is now your wife.
Yeah.
Was there markers maybe or moments where you think God was trying to get your attention? You mentioned the bank teller thing, but between that and in between times, can you look back and go, the Lord was trying to get my attention? Because I know my own life. Like I was in a season early on in college where I wasn't following Christ, but God kept showing up almost literally at my door through people. Was there some moments like that you can look back and see, or was it just all absent of the voice of God or the God trying to get your attention?
I would say there were traumatic moments where, like, I remember so 30 people that I was close to have either committed suicide or overdosed and died while I was in the industry and since I've been out. So seeing those people that were doing the same things I was doing dying, that's why, in my opinion, the best time to share the gospel is at a funeral. You know, you're faced with eternity, and where there's death, there's questions. And yeah. I think like that was sobering at times. There were things that I experienced where bodily harm, like, or death, like should have happened to me. There were places and situations that I was in that there was something that was bigger than me that didn't make sense to the eye why I was alive and the people around me were not. And then there were times in my life where I think shame is not from God, but conviction certainly is. And I think that there were times where, like, for example, my brother graduated. My brother is he's got a PhD. He teaches genetics at Clemson University. And I remember being at one of his 15 graduations and being there, and someone recognized me from being in the industry. And I just remember like feeling just embarrassed and thinking through, like, through my shame, I felt conviction of, man, there were times in my brother's life and in my mother's life that I didn't show up and they needed me. And I wasn't there because I couldn't be there or not because they didn't want me there. It was my shame that caused me to separate myself from them, and being in direct conflict with, I'm living a life that is causing me to separate myself from my family, and it's me that's creating the separation because of the life that I'm living. And it was just something I was wrestling with that I just couldn't reconcile. And unfortunately, like many of those times, I suppressed them. I didn't process them with people. I didn't tell anyone. It was just conversations that I had with myself in my own head.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what shame does. Shame pushes us into hiding, you know.
Sure.
Conviction is what draws us to the Lord. Shame is what presses us to that withdrawal, to that hiding. So it's interesting that you felt that kind of counterbalance or both of those. So take us, you're on this run with Hope. She asks you if you know God or if God exists. How does the story continue from there?
Yeah. So, I mean, the story ends with, you know, us having this long conversation. She tells me she's been following Jesus since she was in the seventh grade. And if Jesus is the foundation of her life, she's like, I'm not perfect by any means, but our relationship with him is the basis in which I make the decisions that I make. And, that walk ends and we text throughout the week. And then she invites me to church. I go to church and I hear, this really beautiful sermon, and it's correlating Mephibosheth and David bringing him back into the kingdom, restoring his land. And Mephibosheth even saying, he's like, you know, I'm a dead dog. Like, who am I to, you know, to be in your presence, to have these things? And then he's like, well, the pastor's like, well, you know, Romans 3:23 says that we've all sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And Romans 6:23 says the wage of sin is death. So who's guilty? Everyone. Who's deserving of death? Everyone. But there's good news. And he presents the gospel. And I'm hearing the gospel, and I know in my bones that it's true. The Holy Spirit was gripping me, but I couldn't reconcile the one thing, though. I was wrestling with, man, well, if my own father doesn't want me, how could, or why would God in flesh suffer and die for me? And it just didn't make sense. And I was like, I understand that he was perfect. So he was perfect in his obedience. I understand, but like, but why would he do that? And then he was reading a portion of Hebrews 12 talking about it was a joy set before him. He endured the cross, and the way he was explaining it, it just the love of God all of a sudden made its way into my heart. And I understood that there the thing that I was longing for most, which was a loving father, I had access to. And when I realized it was love that sent Christ to the cross, and it was love that he had for me, that changed everything. And that was the thing that chipped away enough at my heart where I surrendered, and you know, I gave my life to Christ. And that was, you know, almost 9 years ago. And right away, so I give my life to Christ. About, you know, that same week, you know, this happens on Sunday. The same week I go to this church and I'm like, hey, I've got a story to share. I was talking with the executive pastor at the time. So this church is a Hope Community Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. And Gary Vett was the executive pastor at the time. And he points me to this guy, Andrew Yates. So he had recently moved from Dallas, graduated from DTS, and he was now at this church. He was going to help launch an additional campus, and he discipled me. And the more that he turned me on to the Bible, I couldn't get enough of it. And he ended up, you know, spending about 15 to 20 hours a week with me for several years. And I was, you know, doing everything I could to be in his presence. I just wanted to sit with him, and just a really gifted teacher. When I think about like people like discipling someone, it's just like him sitting with me, walking with me, not just like teaching me the Bible and, you know, just like observation, interpretation, application, like all that. Yes. But sitting with me and like allowing me to process tough questions with him and just really like encouraging me. It's like, man, you're only going to grow at the rate and be free at the rate that you're willing to be honest. So if you're going to trust me, I need you to be honest, and I'm going to be honest with you. And throughout my life, I had people to pat me on the back, but what I really needed was a kick in the butt from someone that I knew who loved me, you know, that, yeah. you know, the wounds of a friend, you know,
right.
That's what I needed. I needed someone to create a space where I could be encouraged and challenged. And every Friday, we call them hot conversations, honest, open, and transparent. We would have these conversations mm-hmm. where I would just spill my guts, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly. And we would process those things. And we did that. And, you know, to this day, I still have those conversations. And I think him allowing me to understand how to study the Bible, because, you know, we know like reading the Bible and studying the Bible, very different. And right. he taught me how to study the Bible. And through understanding how to study the Bible, though, it just came alive to me. And I was not, I wasn't a great student, but I was really good at, you know, being able to read something and, you know, recite. You know, I was memorization. Yeah. You know, I was an actor. You know, I was good at, you know, reading something and being able to regurgitate it, but being able to like understand like concepts and, you know, just really understand it in a deep way. It just, the Bible was something that, I don't know, like something came alive in me. Something was different.
It's so interesting that you talk about discipleship, because I think what churches tend to do really well is preach the gospel and present the gospel.
Yeah.
And somebody who, no matter what the background is, they give their life to Jesus. What I think sometimes we struggle with is exactly what you walk through, and somebody just being like, hey, we're going to have the hard conversations. We're going to wrestle this out, because we have discipleship classes or groups, and we just kind of lump somebody in there. Maybe we have an assimilation process.
Yeah.
But it sounds like Andrew Yates was like, let's walk this thing out together.
Yeah.
Like, let's life on life, day to day, like endure the good, the bad, the ugly. And I think that's a beautiful part of the story, because it's one thing. I think God like radically saved you.
Yeah.
100% believe that in that moment. But that's where the work begins.
Oh, sure.
Like, sometimes we think like salvation happens good. That's where the work begins.
Yeah, that sanctification like process.
And stepped in the gap. And what I want to know is we know from research that pornography, just being an observer, affects the brain. So I can't imagine what it did as a participant. What was it like to, as you referenced Romans 12:12, have a renewed mind? What was that process like for you to rethink your whole self and existence?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I like thinking about like that verse in like Romans 12:2, it's what's even going back to the verse one, it's like, okay, who am I? What am I supposed to be? I'm supposed to be a living sacrifice that's pleasing unto the Lord. And then I'm either going to be conformed by the world, or I'm going to go through this metamorphosis. I'm going to be transformed by the renewing of my mind. Why? So that I can know, I can test and approve what is God's good, pleasing, and perfect will. So I can understand that there is this moral authority where I can compare and contrast. And where I really leaned into it was I understood, if I want to be a good athlete, I need to have a coach. If I want to be a good actor, mm-hmm. I need to have a coach. I need constructive criticism and someone to tell me, am I doing a good job? Am I progressing? Am I growing? Because without stress, without constructive criticism, there can't be change. So there has to be this comparison and contrast so that I can move in a different direction. Because if I'm not growing, I'm dying. If I'm not growing, I'm regressing. And, you know, like you were saying, that sanctification process, I am drifting towards sin. Romans 7, I'm desiring to do the thing I ought not do. I have to struggle to do the thing that I'm called to do. I need to struggle to do the things that God says is best for me. And then once I become satiated in the Word of God, satisfied spending time in the presence of God, then and only then will the things that used to pull me in the wrong direction that I found comfort in that chaotic space, because I come from trauma. I come from chaos. Yeah. I come from, you know, all these things, but they were normal to me. So we can find normalcy in chaos. And when you are put in a stressful situation, what you want to do, that's just the way that, you know, the neuroscience of the brain works. I am going to deflect to or regress back to what I have found comfortable in. And it, even if it's chaotic, even if it's, you know, detrimental to my life, if that's what I know, that's what I'm going to find comfort in. And if I allow myself to regress in that direction, I will. I have to fight that. So for me, yes, that there was a lot of stuff I needed to confront. But what I was willing to say, man, the life that I was living, it left me unsatisfied and it nearly killed me. I want something else. And it, and then it's like, man, I changed my circle. And at the same time, I was, you know, like, you know, I gave my life to Christ the week after Easter, you know, 9 years ago. And then we were I meet this girl and then we're on this journey together and we're engaged by October. So, but like throughout this process, it's like purity was my only option, you know, like that was the only option. So like with her, I was like, okay, I'm supposed to date this gorgeous girl and like not hook up with her. Like this is crazy. But she's like, well, we're going to honor God with our lives individually and collectively. And that's what that looks like. So was I frustrated with that? Yes. Did I have inappropriate thoughts? Yes. But along the way, there was a balance of grace and truth. There was grace and truth along the way where, you know, I don't remember exactly, but like I may have like watched like pornography or something like that, like in that period. I don't think so, but I definitely probably wanted to, because I wanted to hook up with this girl that I had these feelings for. But what really started to shape the way that I saw is that I respected this girl and I loved her. Mm. And what I began to believe and begin to understand was I had never experienced love before. I'd only experienced lust. And all of a sudden I was satisfied in a way that I'd never been before. And like, I mean, for me, as crazy as it was, I had to learn to have normal conversation with her. Like after you get past the, you know, how'd you grow up? What foods do you like? What kind of hobbies do you have?
Yeah.
Like when you're sitting in silence with someone and all you know is like, if we're in a house with no one there and doors are closed, like sex is the only expectation because that's the only way that I know how to engage with another female. Like that, if that's all I know, that's not only all I know, that's what I expect. All of a sudden, okay, that's now off the table. What am I to do? Yeah. So like learning to, you know, get to know her and have these conversations. So I was both growing as an individual and, you know, just developing these new, cause like, man, I was messed up. Like, you know, you think I did over 1,000 pornographic scenes in 6 years. So I was taking something that was supposed to be the most intimate thing that a husband and wife could possibly do. That was representative of Christ in the church, you know, with this holy union. And I was, you know, it became as normal as me, you know, walking into any job, you know, clocking in and clocking out. What was difficult for me was having real conversations with people, looking people in the eye, like shaking someone's hand and looking them in the eye made me so uncomfortable. But I could have sex with anyone, anywhere in front of 100 people without blinking an eye because that had become normal to me. And like having to change that was hard, but it was my only option, you know?
So I want to unpack this a little bit because my brain's like just whirling at the dog, right? So you're learning, you get saved and your relationship with hope is just starting.
Yeah.
And so you're learning about the Lord, but you're also learning the intimacy of being just a human being, which I think a lot of us struggle with. Like, and again, wherever we come from, I think intimacy is just something a lot of us just naturally struggle with. So
And I
what was it like to sort of go ahead?
I was going to say, so, I mean, it was a very long process, to get to where I am today. You know, so my wife and I, so this year we have been married for 8 years. And, so I had to, number one, learn the character of God. Fall deeply in love with him. And then I had to learn to love myself. But before I could forgive myself, I had to learn to love myself because I was so sure, and my identity was born out of, okay, I'm fatherless and I'm a bad person. And that was the first thing that my wife confronted with me. My wife said, "You're not defined by the greatest thing you've ever done or the worst thing you ever do." Well, I thought I was defined by my fatherlessness. I thought I was defined by my behavior, my failures. And she's like, "No, that's not who you are. Those things are true about you, but they are not a nucleus in which you form your identity." And I had to seek God and fall in love with him and learn his character so that I could begin to love myself. And then once I began to love myself, then I began to understand the thing that I needed to release was, hey, guess what? You made some mistakes along the way, and it was upon your own volition that you did these things. And while the trauma that happened to you and the lack of not having a father is impacting the way that you see yourself, but it is not a direct catalyst for what you do. So I had blamed my father for my behavior. And that's just not how it works. You have free will. Right. God chose to send his son into this world. He lived a perfect life. He died on the cross. He rose again. But these were choices. He chose to do these things. Mm-hmm. Yes, like he's fully God, fully man. He chose. There was a choice that he made. He laid down his life for you. Now you, a reasonable response to the gospel is now for you to lay down your life for him. Mm. And what that looks like is taking ownership of your sin. My father's absence was not a catalyst for my sin. I can frame it that way, but I made the choice. So when I got to a place where I took ownership of my sin, I made these decisions upon my own volition, and I need to release the frustration or the thought of my life would have been different if he would have been there. I wouldn't have done these things if he would have been there. So I had to extend forgiveness to him. And through that, I was able to forgive myself. And then and only then, I reached a level of consecration where I could experience God in a new way. So like those were the things that allowed me to become more healthy, because I had to release those things. And I think there's levels of consecration, but again, you can only be as free as you're honest.
Mm-hmm.
So
I completely agree. And I think you're being in the porn industry is different than most, but I think there's a lot of us who would say, hey, the dad thing, whether dad was present or not, I think a lot of us have this struggle with our fathers. I think it's very common in the culture we're in, absent dads, absent fathers. It's a prominent conversation, and it does affect how we see God as father.
Sure.
It affects how we experience God. It's a huge piece. And I think what you said was so critical is that you had to forgive your father and forgive yourself. And so sometimes forgiveness, and maybe you're, I don't know your story of how you forgave your dad, isn't always going to that person, but simply releasing them of the debt that you feel like they owe you.
Yeah. Your trust. So I had to trust that, guess what? God is the perfect judge. He is completely just. So I'm going to trust him as judge in that scenario, and I'm going to relinquish that debt that I believe that my father owes me. Because what we can do most most often, not just in a relationship scenario, but I think it makes sense. It'll probably be best understood in that scenario for people listening. If reconciliation doesn't meet your expectations, you can often withhold forgiveness. If you don't think that reconciliation is going to happen the way that you want it to, you will withhold that forgiveness. Yeah. And the thing that you do when you withhold forgiveness, it impacts you. You are holding yourself captive right. by withholding the forgiveness. And you are the one that becomes bitter. You are the one mm-hmm. that pays the price. And just, I have to trust God is a perfect judge. I'm going to relinquish the debt to him. And I'm going to trust that he's going to sort that out. And I don't have to, but what I am called to is to forgive because I've been forgiven much. And when I understood yeah. that was a game changer for me. But yeah, I think a lot of people, it's like, man, if things aren't going to end up the way that I want them, then I'm not going to forgive the person. Because reconciliation with my father, it didn't end up the way that I thought it would. Because I forgave him. We had the conversations. But guess what? I'm meeting my father at 30 and we live on different, you know, sides of the country. And he's interested in a lot of different things that I am. So,
right.
like, sure, we talk every once in a while, but are we best friends? Like, do we talk often? We don't. And I think mm-hmm. if I would have known that, that might would have caused me to not take the step forward that that I did. But I think, like, we just have to be okay with that. And that doesn't mean I don't stop yeah. pursuing him or I allow that to cause any kind of frustration in my life. But at the same time, like, I have to just let go of that. And if it doesn't turn into what I hoped it would be, I have to be okay with it.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So, like, I think that's so true. Like, we have this movie script in our mind of what the moment's going to be like when we offer forgiveness, especially with the dad. Like, it's going to be this, like, Hallmark moment.
Yeah, like, rock, reconciliation,
a big hug. Yeah, yeah. And, like, it's going to be the greatest ever. We're going to be best friends, and he's going to be the dad I always needed or whatever. You know, because sometimes we think that, and it's not about the reconciliation as much as it is releasing the debt.
Yeah.
Like, and going, hey, you, I'm going to forgive you for that. Even if they don't think they're wrong or know they're wrong. Sometimes we just harbor the bitterness.
Yeah, I mean, that's,
so it's great to hear you've done that.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the, like, so. Like this. Like that's the last chapter. That's like the last lie.
Yeah.
So it's taking seven lies of culture and putting it under a microscope. And it's like, here's what the world says. And then this yeah. is how me believing that lie was detrimental to my life. And here's how the word of God superseded that lie, dismantled it, destroyed it, and allowed me to experience the fullness of what God has for me. But just that forgiveness. So
let's quickly talk about the projects you have coming up, because you referenced the book, The Seven Lies That Ruin Your Life, which will be released the week this episode's release. But also you have out right now the Unmentionable podcast, excuse me, what, a documentary style podcast telling your story, also telling the story of the porn industry and the detriment there. What do we not know? We often think, like, porn is harmless. Like, we just think, oh, you know, it's just boys being boys and now girls being girls, because it's yeah. from both genders right now that are watching and consuming pornography.
Yeah.
Do we not know about the industry that we think it's so unassuming or so safe?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it points to how addictive it is from a monetization standpoint. It makes more money than Disney and Netflix combined. Makes more money mm-hmm. than NBA, Major League Baseball, and the NFL all combined. 33% right. of all the data transferred on the internet on a daily basis is pornography. So it's being wow. consumed at an astronomical rate. Yet, you know, we would be naive to believe that we can consume something at this rate and it not have from a neuroscience standpoint, because when I do a lot of talks around this subject, even in secular mm-hmm. spaces, I'll generally, like, here's what it does to your brain, here's how it has an impact on your heart, and here's the impact that it has in your world, and here's what the Bible has to say about it. But, you know, it's as detrimental to your brain as heroin or cocaine. 94% of pornography depicts violence, and that has a very real carryover into rape culture and abuse. You know, it's contributing to sex trafficking. It's contributing to children being harmed. And these aren't just fictitious things that I'm saying. It's like the most popular niche within pornography is this teen porn. And there's girls that are wearing pigtails and stockings. Like, what does that depict? Wow. That's not depicting a teenager. That's depicting a child.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, people are becoming, you know, addicted to these imageries, and then they can't be satiated in real life, and they're going and acting out, you know, in their real life. So, yes, and 50, you know, the data tells us 54% of divorces that happen within the United States have something to do with pornography. Either it was pornography consumption or pornography addiction that led to infidelity within their marriage in a relationship, whether it's online or in person. But it's, you know, it's breaking up the home. It's causing people to do things they never would otherwise. And, you know, there's tons of research around it is a large contributor to the mental health crisis because it is a catalyst for anxiety. It's a catalyst for depression.
Yeah.
And all these things. And it's like, if I'm living my life in this space where there's this integrity gap, and I'm struggling in silence because it's so easy to do that because of these, you know, there's no barrier for entry. I can look at it whenever I want for as long as I want, and I can access it for free. What's stopping me from doing that? And it's like, man, it is, I think, the most destructive thing in society today.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I agree. And so how do we, maybe we have parents listening, maybe we have spouses listening, but it's completely so accessible compared to when I was growing up, where you had to go buy the dirty magazine off the rack or go to the secret room in the video store. How can we guard against just, and I hate to say accidentally, but people almost bumping into it? Like, it's everywhere we turn almost.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's so easy to safeguard your phones. So I would say you need to have some kind of software. Everybody, I and everyone on our team, like, we use Covenant Eyes. I even have a 30 day. So it's like my last name in 30. Broom 30. Anyone anywhere can use that and get it free for 30 days. But it's only as good as your accountability partner. So yes, you will download a VPN on your phone, and yes, it will block you accessing, you know, adult anything associated with you know, adult words or adult websites, anything with sexual explicit content on it. But yeah, that report is going to a person. And if that report is going to a person, if there's no accountability there, and I would say, like, that's the gap. Like, accountability, in my experience, it's not, oh man, you looked at that again. Like, gosh, man, you know better than that. Let's pray. Or it can't be, man, you did that again. All right, we're calling your wife. Let's call her right now. There has to be some middle ground of saying, hey, you said that you didn't want to do this anymore. You said that it was leading you down a path you didn't want to go on. This is not the person that you want to become. I care about you. So what I want to ask you is, why did you say yes to going to that website? Why didn't you call me or text me because you didn't just end up there. You see something, you know, we go back to David. David saw something he shouldn't have seen, and then he did something he shouldn't have did. And then instead of trying to clear his browser history, he killed Uriah. You know, so when we that first thing that happens, you know, if it's the thing that trips me up, the thing that I saw on Instagram, the thing that I saw on a movie, the girl that I saw at the gym, whatever it is, if I confess the first thing, then it's not going to grow and I'm going to stop it where it is. And, you know, so I need to confess it why it's small is what I need to do. But I need someone in my life that I'm going to be brutally honest with, and they're going to love me enough to be honest with me. So I would say that. So how do we, you know, how do we be proactive? Number one, I need to have my smart devices locked down, but also I need to be proactive in my life. You know, I need to take inventory of my life. What are the things that I'm watching? What are the things that I'm listening to? Who are the people who are speaking into my life? Because what I consume externally is going to impact my internal, and it's going to impact the decisions that I make. So I need to take inventory of the things that I'm allowing into my life. And also I need to be proactive in having, you know, having my smart devices locked down. And also I need to be smart. You know, if I'm someone that struggles with this, for me, I simply did this. I did not take any technology into my room or bathroom for over 5 years. That was something I didn't do because I knew if I had access to technology where there was a closed door, it would open a door for me to do something I didn't want to do.
So
I needed to be proactive in, like, I need to identify triggers. I need to create boundaries. But the most important thing, I need someone in my life that's going to hold me to the standard in which I want to pursue. Not the standard that I live at, the standard that I want to hold myself to. Because, and that's the beauty of the Bible. The Bible is a moral authority, a line in the sand. Again, Romans 12:2. Either I'm living a life that's according to what God's perfect, pleasing will is, or I'm not. And I can hold my life up to this word and say, am I measuring up? And if I'm not, I'm faced with a decision. Do I want to do what I want to do, or am I going to submit to what God says is best?
Yeah, that's great. No, I think these are, man, I call them handlebars, but great kind of points of reference for anybody who's struggling. And what makes a good accountability partner, accountability is kind of a muddy word sometimes in the church. Like it's overused in some ways and it's abused in some ways and it's not done well in a lot of spaces. But I mean, I think it is a critical component. Like, you have to have somebody who, I love you said, is to confess the first thing to before it gets out of control. Because I think it can quickly, as addictive as pornography is, as anything, it can quickly spin out of control on us.
Yeah. And then, I mean, you see the technological advances with AI. We're talking, you know, this is happening now where, you know, you can get an AI girlfriend, and there's porn that is catered to you. So think about the beauty of this. My wife knows exactly how I like my food season. She knows where I want to eat. She knows all these things. So she can take something that I like and make it something that I love. AI can take something that you are desiring, cater it to you individually, and how much more is that going to be addictive to you? So we're facing something just crazy, and just the reality of this. MindGeek recently rebranded themselves as Alo, and they are the largest producer of pornography, and we see. So I was in Capitol Hill a few months ago, and there was this symposium where a few of us were speaking at, and they were talking about how, you know, there were these age verification proposals where certain states were implementing this legislation where you needed to have a government issued ID to access anything that was sexually explicit. And Pornhub or Alo, their response to this was they created an app that is called VPN Hub, and that goes around the VPN that the states install. And here's the thing that gets crazy. That app, it's rated 4 and up. It's for 4 years old and up. So if you don't think
it's crazy
that the industry that like their own record saying this, they create content and marketing dollars go towards pedophiles. They're on record saying this. My friend Arden Young, she works for an organization called Sound Investigations. And they went undercover, and she heard from the lips of 8 different executives that work within these places where they're saying, yes, we are putting advertising dollars towards people who are consuming this content. We know who's consuming it. And yes, we are putting those dollars where, you know, they're pedophiles. And it's insane. There, like right now, there's technology that exists where you can grab a child's. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Joshua, thank you for doing the work you're doing and bringing this to light. Man, it means a whole lot to a lot of people. I hope that our listeners are gaining from this and learning something. I want to give you opportunity to speak to the upcoming book. It's The 7 Lies That Will Ruin Your Life. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I wrote that over the last 2 years. So 7 Lies That Will Ruin Your Life. And what is just true is if you believe a lie to be true, that lie becomes true to you. And through that lie, you see the world. And we're looking at 7 big lies that culture propagates as your best life, success, sex, forgiveness. We're looking at these things and saying, what does the world say about these things? And me believing that lie, how it was detrimental to my life, but then also how me believing what was true, how the word of God superseded that lie, dismantled this false, you know, worldview that I had, and actually allowed me to experience the fullness of what God has for me. That's what I want for people. That's what I want for myself. That's what I want for my family. So it's life lessons that I learned, but an eternal truth that's available in the Word of God that is so important. It changed my life, and that's why I wrote that book. And at the same time, I would just say my big hope for the book and my big hope for the podcast is that a lot of people in evangelical circles, it's very popular to talk about the Great Commission. And I think the lack of discipleship is found in the integrity gap of there's a generation struggling with pornography consumption. So why are people not sharing the gospel? Because they're living in habitual sin, and there's no boldness and authority that comes with walking in the Spirit when you're living in sin. So I think through the eradication of this sin struggle, and through confession, and through being in the right community, being in the right relationship with the right accountability partner, and just becoming free, because you're only as free as you're honest. And if you're honest with this, the unmentionable thing, like the podcast talks about, when the thing that you believe is unmentionable is mentioned and brought into light, there's healing and freedom. And that is where the Spirit of the Lord will be. And that is where freedom will be found. And that is where we're going to see the church move in the direction that we all hope it will be.
Joshua, thanks for coming on. Let me ask you one for everything you've shared with us. Since the show is titled The Collective's Conversation, who is one person, historical, present, fictional, or real life that you would want to sit down and have a conversation with?
I think I would love to, probably Billy Graham. I'd love to just, I heard so many like great stories about him. I would love to just sit down and talk with him. So either him or Abraham Lincoln. I would love to just sit in a room and, you know, have some food and just listen to them.
Joshua, thanks for coming on. It's been such a joy to have you on the show. You've been such a blessing to so many around this conversation. Your story's impacted so many lives. And I look forward to the book. And I know it comes out this week as we release this episode, and wish you all the best. And as we say here at the Collective's Conversation, you've got a seat at the table. Thanks.
Hey, friends. Thank you for joining us on another incredible episode of the Collective's Conversations podcast. If you enjoyed today's discussion and want to stay connected to the Collective's Conversation, make sure to follow us on your preferred podcast platform. If something of the show really spoke to you, tag me on Instagram at Jeff_Pitts_. It would mean so much if you take a moment to rate and review the podcast. It goes a long way into shaping the future of our episodes and reaching a broader audience. We'll see you next week at the table for another great conversation. And be sure to check our follow-up episode titled Things I Learned every Tuesday following that week's episode. And remember, you have a seat at the table.